Hey, Patrick.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm good.
So we're reading the replies to Mearsheimer's The False Promise of International Institutions.
There's no long introduction needed. There are a bunch of people. There's no way for us to introduce all the people. And some of them we've actually introduced before. Some of them, most every one of them, I think that many of our listeners will already know.
Mm-hmm. It was very much a who's who of IR, quote unquote, paradigms in that period of time in the mid-1990s.
Let's just name them, right? We won't give their biographies. We'll just say who they are.
Yeah. So we have Robert Cohen and Lisa Martin. And then we have Charlie Kupchan and Clifford Kupchan. And then we have John Ruggie. And we have Alex Wendt. And then a reply from John himself.
And that's quite a blend of scholars, so maybe we should talk about the whiskey selection.
And so we're gonna go out on a limb here. We're gonna do something different we've never done on Whiskey and IR before, which is we're gonna drink something that's not a single malt. That's what I'm doing tonight. So because it's a blend, I'm gonna drink one of the two blends, well, three blends that I actually like. This is Monkey Shoulder, and Monkey Shoulder is named for the ailment that the workers at the would get when they were turning the malt. You'd have to use a shovel to turn the malt, and if you did that too much, you would sort of be working one shoulder, and so you would get these pains in your shoulder. They call that monkey shoulder, and so that is what this particular malt is named for. This is actually a bottle of Batch 27 Monkey Shoulder, which is quite yummy, and think it is appropriate for a time when we're going to be having a blend of critiques. So, and you're drinking something different though, Dan. What are you drinking?
Well, I have an Aberlour and something that you could pronounce, but I probably can't.
So it's one of the particular cask. Yeah.
The irony here is that I do have Monkey Shoulder, but it's at my in-law's house. It's what I keep up there if I want to have scotch up there. Because it's New York and everything is expensive, and so when I went to the liquor store, that was the least, like, outrageously expensive thing that I wanted to drink.
That is definitely one thing about the economics of whiskey. Blends are cheaper. So a bottle of Monkey Shoulder will run, like, half to a third of some of the other bottles that we've consumed or broken open here on the program.
All right, well, cheers.
So, yeah, cheers.
Hmm. Yeah, I wish I had the ability to describe whiskey, which I do not. It definitely is a little medicine-y in the aftertaste.
Mm.
Got some tingling, but it's really good. It's smooth. So how's the Monkey Shoulder?
Yeah, nice. Nice. It is, as Monkey Shoulder always is, it's easy. Sort of easy drinking. It is not quite as sweet as a bourbon, but definitely has a little bit of sort of cane sugar floating on it, which is interesting. It's mostly a blend of it's made by the folks who make Glenfiddich, so it's a blend of the Glenfiddich and a couple of the other whiskeys that they produce there on the property. So yes,
I think that in principle, some of this should be straightforward, because we made a tactical decision that we were not going to read the replies until after we'd done the episode where we talked about Mearsheimer. And I think that we covered most of the stuff in the replies. You know, I think we just, whether we had some distant memory of reading them, or whether it's low-hanging fruit, or whether, you know, it's just great minds think alike and then there's us, whatever it might be, I think we've covered a lot of the substance, although there are some things that I thought were worth pulling out. What I found interesting was the tonal difference between the various participants, from pissed off just kind of wary of the whole, just kind of weary of the whole thing, to let's get in a circle and all talk to one another, right? Which is Alex's way of handling it. Okay, so we go in order, do you think? Talk with them in order?
I think it makes sense. That's probably the best way to do it, is to start with Cohan and Martin and then move on from there.
So they basically cover what you would expect from a liberal institutionalist defense of liberal institutionalism. The one thing that struck me as particularly interesting was that in their discussion of liberalism as being broader than just the very narrow thing that Mearsheimer attacks, they do get ecumenical in a way that I thought was worth mentioning. Well, what I mean is that...
ecumenical. Expand on that a
little bit. There's more norms talk, for example, than I expected. How's that? And I think that's just a matter of forgetting the ways in which changing norms and expectations were really deeply integrated into the idea about what reciprocal and repeated interaction does to international cooperation.
Right. Right, and I think also the time period matters here, because this is written in, 95? So this is just a couple of years after Wendt's 92 piece, which we've discussed in an earlier episode, in which Wendt was precisely calling for a liberal constructivist alliance around these notions of norm. And this is also the time period in which a lot of liberals are playing with understandings of norms, which are maybe culturally thin, but are still something other than pure rationality. So there is some breadth there to the liberal conception at this point.
There is an interesting strategic move here, which is that Cohan and Martin decide, hell yeah, this is about a paradigm slapdown. They don't take a position where they try to walk back the kind of paradigm wars aspect of it. If you look at like page 41, they go all in, right? Mounting anomalies in realism cannot explain things. Realism is treated as a approach writ large in this instance, although there are times when it is less so and it's more Mearsheimer's version. But here, Mearsheimer wants to make the fight about paradigms in toto. They're going to make the fight about paradigms in toto.
And they're going to claim the high ground of science, which they do repeatedly throughout the piece. On page 41, which you just mentioned, there's the line that sort of crystallized it for me. Institutionalism, in contrast, seeks to state in advance the conditions under which its propositions apply. So, yes, we're going to make it a paradigm smackdown, and we're going to prove that we're more scientific than our realist alternatives.
First of all, it's exactly what you would expect. Secondly, it can be an effective critique, just because there's always been this kind of haze around realism's scientific status, at least since the 70s. Is that true? When did it kind of settle in, the idea that realism was no longer scientific? Or is that just how we've been taught this history? We don't really know this history. Do you remember when we interviewed Nick Onuf for the Ducker Minerva podcast, and his understanding of like what the field was like in the early 70s really was realism dominance, being excluded from journals, all that kind of stuff. And we look back and I think we see a discipline that doesn't look very realist, and where a lot of the work looks like it's codas for realism. So I don't know how to square that.
Yeah, something has definitely shifted in that 10-15 year period there. I don't know the historiography well enough of that period, but certainly by the time you get to someone like John Vasquez, then you have a clear argument that realism is not scientific and is just an ideological reproduction of the assumptions of great power politics. It seems like the scientific status of realism is being well contested by the early 1980s.
I was thinking about like Haas's essay on the concept of the balance of power, which is also a claim that there's just deep conceptual confusion.
Mm-hmm. And certainly if you look at something like Nicholas Guillot's work on the Carnegie meetings in the mid-1950s, there's all these questions about whether realism can be a science, and a tactical adopting of the idea of science as a way of legitimating a realpolitik narrative. So there's certainly, we've got the approximate endpoints somewhere in the mid-50s and somewhere in the early 1980s. But certainly by the time Cohen and Martin are writing in the mid-90s, the claim they're making is, I think, pretty uncontroversial for the time.
Certainly, yeah.
That no, the new kids on the block are the ones who are the real scientists.
It's interesting because we're in a period where actually what it means to do science in the field is fairly inchoate, right? Something about prediction, like what we call kind of baseline neopositivism. But the methodology is not so well developed.
No. Though there is something on the next page, on page 42, which, because again, this is 1995. So King, Cohen, and Verba comes out in 1994. And, you know, the overlapping set there is, of course, Cohen. But on 42, institutions are important independently only in the ordinary sense used in social science. Controlling for the effects of power and interest, it matters whether they exist. Which is interesting because it's a methodological definition of what it means for institutions to independently matter, not a theoretical argument about institutions mattering. Whereas most of what Mearsheimer is doing is a theoretical argument about institutions. What Cohen and Martin fall back to is a methodological question. Independence means basically that the coefficient is statistically significant in a regression equation.
Yeah, but it's paired with this argument that Mearsheimer is setting the bar for what liberalism is at, you know, institutions can eliminate war, and that's not what they're arguing. Right? So, I mean, in a sense, yes, it is interesting, but it's also consistent with the way that they are redefining, and I mean redefining in a negative way, just redefining from Mearsheimer what the standard of success for liberalism is. Essentially, we do not think, you know, institutions can bring about perpetual peace. Certainly not in their future, if ever. But we do think that they matter and they're worthy of study. And I guess you're right. There is a very strong methodological tinge to that. It's one of those things where if Mearsheimer had doubled down less on claims about social science and rigor, this would have been a harder piece to write. And I don't mean the sense of being, you know, if Mearsheimer were to say, I am not rigorous, then he would win the debate. I mean, if he didn't lay so much on these kinds of things like, well, what does it mean to say institutions matter? Right? Because there are glimmers of that in Mearsheimer's response. Like, there's a point when he's saying, you know, look, I'm not saying this thing that sounds absurd. But then, of course, he then turns around and says that thing that sounds absurd, and it's not clear which he's saying, and Martin and Cohen call him on this a couple of times, and I think they're right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is the trap, and again, I mentioned Nicholas Guillot earlier, but you know, when he talks about the kind of gambit that classical realists played, taking this language of science and saying, we are a science. And we use that epistemic authority of science to buttress the kinds of claims that we're making. The problem with playing that game is that then you actually have to play it. Then you actually have to be rigorously consistent in precisely this way. So I think what Cohen and Martin are doing here is quite correctly pointing out that once Mearsheimer said, this is the game I'm playing, he's vulnerable to exactly these
kinds of critiques.
I wasn't
very happy with Mearsheimer. I thought it was clever, but for taking a couple of those hoisted by your own petard moves, I don't think that's quite what's going on here, though, because I think Martin and Cohen are both committed to scientificism in the neopositive mode.
Yes.
Although Cohen will become more ambivalent about that in the last 15 years or whatever, but nonetheless, they want to be on this ground. It's not that they are. It's not that they are trying to out debate him by adopting his position.
No, I agree. I think the issue is not that they are just adopting his profession provisionally the way you would in a debate round, but because Mearsheimer has claimed that ground, he makes himself vulnerable to exactly these sorts of critiques. And later on, when Mearsheimer and Walt will start writing about the problems of scientism when it comes to thinking about IR, in a way, and I think this is the point you were making earlier, in a way, that makes that argument less vulnerable.
Except for, and I thought you were going to literally anticipate what I was going to say, but not quite. Except for, this is another frustration I have. So they have a very rhetorically forceful, I think it unfortunately picks on some junior scholars, but for people who were junior at the time, but a very forceful piece in the end of IR theory about kind of the naive hypothesis testing, not having enough theory guidance, and not having enough explicit theoretical parameters put on what you're doing. But there, of course, I think they run into the same problem, which is that because they still want to articulate a kind of something that's somewhere between Millesianism and that is logic of difference and agreement and logic of joint agreement and difference, or whatever the combination of the two is called, and what's really just quasi-statistical. There's a sort of way in which the argument is ineffective, because if that's the ground you're going to stand on, as we've talked about before at least a million times, I don't know, from this podcast, your small n work is never going to be better than the large n version. Right. You'll be much more vulnerable to the problem of, you know, admitted variable bias, everything else, right? So,
And what I thought was actually the most interesting in some ways about the Cohen and Martin critique is that even though most of it is about this methodological stuff, they do sometimes actually have substantive critiques of Mearsheimer's position, which is fascinating the way it kind of creeps in there. So I'm thinking of this particular sentence on page 46. Institutionalized reciprocity and distributional concerns are simply two sides of the same coin. Sort of standard liberal line, right? Reflecting the difficulties of cooperating in a system lacking centralized enforcement and pointing to the need for reliable sources of information. And this is the key clause right here. If states are to achieve gains from cooperation. And that's one of those moments where, despite the fact that the majority of the Cohen and Martin response is on methodological grounds, there's also a theoretical difference. They are arguing that states want to achieve gains from cooperation, where Mearsheimer doesn't think states have any interest in achieving gains from cooperation. And that's not a methodological question, that's a theoretical issue.
There are two other things that I thought were interesting that were, they're not purely substantive, they have a methodological component, but I thought that they were, but they're not simply, you know, like, who's more scientific. So one of them is that, and this is at the very end, they say that the most, they say that basically the biggest effect they find from institutions, or that liberal institutionalists have found, is essentially issue linkage and information provision, right? So yeah. This is on the bottom of 49. However, the major effect of institutions, this is in the Martin study, came through institutionalized linkages that would otherwise have been non-existent, a linkage between EC budget contributions and the sanctions issue. Prevention of cheating is not the only mechanism by which institutions facilitate cooperation. By creating issue linkages, they allow for more effective retaliation against cheaters and also create scope for mutually beneficial exchanges. First of all, I think this is dead on. Right, I think it's just correct in terms of the arguments that Mearsheimer makes. But also, this is a moment where I thought there's a theory debate that could have happened. Right? And the theory debate could have been the Waltzian position about process versus structure versus their position. Because Mearsheimer is essentially taking that position when he makes claims of epiphenomenality. But of course, Waltz doesn't think that institutions at any given moment are necessarily epiphenomenal. He just thinks their effects wash out, which is a different kind of claim. His theory of international politics is not a theory of processes. You can go out and have process theories. And that's a position that says, hey, there's some room for coexistence. Admittedly, Waltz says different things about the scope for that coexistence at different times, but would say you're interested in the process questions. I'm interested in the enduring structural order questions, and that's fine.
Right.
My argument is still, I'm still right that if states don't pay attention to relative power over the long haul, they're in trouble. They're going to lose, they're not going to be great powers, they're going to lose their great power status, and so forth. Perhaps because it's deterministic, perhaps because of Mearsheimer's rhetorical style and the way it links up with this theory, it is also more vulnerable, I think, to these kinds of arguments.
Yeah. Yeah, because Cohen and Martin plant their flag on the statistical understanding of independence, which is to say you don't have to actually show that institutions somehow completely undo the effects of anarchy. As long as you can show that controlling for those effects, institutions still have an independent impact. So the absolutism of Mearsheimer's claim makes possible both his misreading of liberalism as being a theory that would somehow only be true if institutions prevented war from happening. But it also makes possible the critique, which is to say, no, institutions do matter. And yes, from a structural realist perspective, they matter at the margins, but that's important because they have an independent effect. If we control for these other things, there is an independent contribution that is made by these institutions. And that's ultimately where Cohen and Martin want to make their claim, right? That's what independence means.
I guess I just want to stress that this is a situation where Mearsheimer's style of very bold claim, walk back the claim a bit, bold claim, then bold it again, kind of becomes a problem because in a sense, right, the false promise of international institutions is set up as a critique of the ability of institutions to bring about perpetual peace, right? That's the argument.
Yes.
And yes. If he wanted to stick with that argument, none of these responses would matter, except for the Kupchin and Kupchin. Mm-hmm. And he probably wouldn't make the same argument against Kupchin and Kupchin. I mean, in essence, if he'd stuck with that claim, he could have sort of sailed over all these kinds of issues. Because he doesn't have to argue that institutions are inconsequential, right? He just has to argue they can't do the thing, the big thing, which is the important thing, which is what he's testing. But of course, in order to make that argument, he then slides into the weeds of these much more specific claims about cooperation and gains, where he is not on solid ground. The way in which the bar changes throughout the article could be, you can change the bar in a way that actually helps you. And I think here it's changed in a way which is not ultimately helpful. People who are committed realists who are going to read this are going to think Mearsheimer's right. And that's the people he wants to convince, that's great. But I don't think that somebody who comes into this with a kind of more neutral position is going to come out feeling like Mearsheimer gets the better of this argument.
Right.
Even though the point he actually says he's making, everybody concedes.
Yep. No, I think that's absolutely, absolutely correct. And all of the responses to Mearsheimer try to walk back from the idea that somehow they are claiming that whatever they are pointing to can resolve the problem of international war. And they all say, no, that's not what we're about. So they have all conceded exactly that minimal point. Let me rephrase that. The one response that doesn't quite walk back from that is the Kupchin and Kupchin response, which conveniently is the next one in the queue.
So yeah, we're now on Kupchin and Kupchin, and they are called the promise of collective security. This is your critique, mostly, right? There's some other stuff going on, but it's what you said last time. This is not collective security. This is not how we understand collective security. But then it gets interesting. Mm-hmm. It is a very interesting, because you don't usually see it argument for the superiority of collective security over balancing in the way they understand collective security.
I mean, they have a very different understanding of what collective security is than Mearsheimer does. And it's different in at least two ways. It's different in terms of the goal, but it's also different in terms of kind of its epistemic status. So they are creatively ambiguous, shall we say, about whether this is a theoretical postulate or a policy prescription. And I think that's kind of endemic to and endogenous to this particular discourse of collective security. So when you get to the near the end, on page 58, when they talk about how it's a collective security, they talk about the profound advantages to institutionalizing a security system that promises to deepen accord among states rather than letting a self-help system take its course and simply hoping the great power conflict doesn't reemerge. I'm not exactly sure whether that's a prescription or whether that's a prediction or exactly what that is. Whatever it is, it's clearly not the rather utopian way that Mearsheimer paints it, that it's kind of a pious wish that there wouldn't be conflict between things. So they either mean a different mode of practice or a theory that suggests that different modes of practice are possible. And it leads us to a very different way of thinking about things. And if you take that Kupchan and Kupchan argument seriously, what they seem to be saying is states are not inevitably required to practice balance of power politics in the way Mearsheimer thinks they are. States could practice another kind of politics. And if they did practice this other kind of politics, there would be different kinds of outcomes. For Mearsheimer, the whole point is states can't practice anything else, except when they do, then they somehow get punished for it. Except it's not quite as clean as it is in Waltz, right? So it's like states shouldn't do this thing. But Kupchan and Kupchan's point, at least I take their point, to be there's really no reason why states can't do these things. It's just that they don't, and therefore these consequences follow. But if they did these other things, which are perfectly possible for them to do, then we would be in a different sort of place. So it's really ships passing in the night in a lot of ways. They're really arguing very different things.
Kind of. If we were to reconstruct the so-called realist-idealist debate, which of course didn't exist, if we were kind of like going to use like linguistic methods and we're like looking for proto-Indo, we're like looking for Indo-European, we're backwards inducing it, we're going to backwards induce idealism. We're going to backwards induce what this would look like if there actually was some commonality, right? And we looked at a lot of discourse and we didn't just kind of say, oh, well, international law will make everybody happy and we can adjudicate all disputes and peace will break out and, you know, a civilized league will protect civilization, or what have you, right? We didn't do those things. If we were to go back and look at what people actually might argue looking backwards about what was wrong with the League of Nations, there would obviously be some issues of design or whatever, but the fundamental argument was the U.S. stayed out.
Right.
And Britain and France, at the end of the day, didn't keep their eyes on the ball because of concerns about the balance of power in Europe. Maybe you'd throw in some stuff about alienating the Japanese. These are essentially pragmatic, practical arguments about things that could have been done differently. I think this argument is much more of a direct clash with Mearsheimer than we think. I mean, it's essentially an argument that just says the way we're talking about practicing power politics is not utopian. We know states have been willing to do this before, willing to do variants of what we propose, like NATO. There's no reason, if they want to, why they can't do it in the future. And there's no reason why they necessarily don't have to want to. So in that sense, it's an argument that is really a kind of anti-structuralist argument. It's an argument that would fit with a liberal reading of Waltz, for example. It's an argument that would fit with certain readings of classical realism, where actually part of the whole point isn't just to warn people not to do naive, stupid things, but it's to teach them how to do those things better. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, it does. It does. And it goes to, by about the middle of page 54, when they're suggesting that in a way, they characterize collective security as something that is almost like an alternative form of balancing.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of in particular.
So, It's a way to, what they say, make aggression less likely by ameliorating the competitive nature of international relations. So in some ways, it becomes an argument about process over structure, to use that kind of opposition, that maybe Mearsheimer is incorrect about the constraining nature of the structure of the international system, that there is more flexibility for process. It's not a direct, there is no such thing as balancing. It's, there's a different way of practicing balancing. There's a different way of practicing international diplomacy that doesn't necessarily lead to these war-prone activities.
I am relatively persuaded by the notion that what they mean by collective security, something like Article 5, which, remember, is not, doesn't require states to do anything. Article 5 does not require states to contribute to a military response. That something like that is essentially a mechanism for more effective balancing, in the sense of saying that instead mm-hmm. of relying on situational alliances to get that counterbalancing coalition together, you have a permanent mechanism and a set of commitments to do it. And the variance is no different right. than that. And actually, I thought that was pretty interesting. And I hadn't thought about that way. And I think I'm partially persuaded.
Yeah, the way they talk about collective security also shades into some of the more recent work on concerts that's been done since this piece was written. I think, for instance, of Jennifer Mitzen's work on the Concert of Europe. And the way that what we're talking about here is not a refutation of the idea that power and balancing matters, but the idea that you can practice that in a very different way. So collective security or a concert system can effectively process differences of capability in a way that doesn't lead to the kind of inevitable war and individual security consequences that Mearsheimer thinks it always leads to.
You know, the more I think about it, maybe this is manufactured, but if you reach back into the deep recesses of like my undergraduate years, I think I remember people like Nye and Hoffman in classes talking about something along these lines when they talked about collective security. I wonder if this is just that we've moved on, and so these arguments aren't as familiar. I mean, this is an outlier. This kind of stuff, I think, has increasingly been relegated to historians of international thought. It's sort of been taken mm-hmm. off the table of our debates. And maybe that's just because it's about kind of prescriptive policy and we don't do as much of that anymore. Maybe it's just because people think, I think probably wrongly, that the League is tapped out. Like, I think Paul Post has done interesting work here. The League is definitely not tapped out. Actually, the whole history of international institutions prior to the Second World War is not tapped out. The whole period needs another rethink in light of kind of current considerations and in light of what historians have done in the archives and stuff like that. There are a lot of ways you can be naive in international politics, and many of them involve the way you practice power politics, I guess I would say.
Right, right. But it is interesting that over the threads of these responses to Mearsheimer, nobody is denying that there are such things as power politics. It's that people are denying that power politics must always take the determinate form that Mearsheimer thinks they have.
I think that there are parts of Cohen and Martin's argument which are along the lines of, you can take some of the power politics out of these politics. It's not, you know, explicit, but you can kind of see it there.
Mm-hmm. But now, Cohen and Martin are definitely the closest to that.
They're definitely the closest, but they don't say that, right? They essentially say this allows for efficiencies, and allows for linkage, it allows for better information, allows for a coordination on what constitutes defection versus cooperation. This is always a facilitating outcomes right. in a power political environment that are mutually beneficial or Pareto improving. And there, mm-hmm. there is a sort of tinge of despite. But although they do say that they also think states just want to do these things. And so, you know, it is a very kind of liberal right. view in that sense. But Yeah, certainly Kupchin and Kupchin are talking about channeling power politics.
Mm-hmm.
Although they do have that wonderful
right.
stuff about Russia. And this is another issue where yes. like it depends a lot on what should means. So on page 59,
mm-hmm.
instead, Russia should be gradually drawn into a European collective security system, increasing the chances that Russians will come to define themselves as members of a European community of nations, not as outsiders. For reasons of its own, Russia may well veer from the path of democratic reform and pursue foreign policy incompatibilities with its participation in a collective security system, but taking cautious, prudent steps towards its inclusion, unless and until Russia demonstrates malign intentions, offers far more promise of preserving peace in Europe than exposing a fragile Russia to the vagaries and insecurities of a self-help world. That's an interesting passage in a lot of respects.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, in addition to being kind of a prescient warning about the future of Russian foreign policy, what's kind of interesting there is that the argument seems to be about potential changes in Russian identity as a result of what kinds of institutions Russia is integrated into. Right? So the mechanism is something like socialization, which is not the idea of the institution being some sort of independent causal factor, but the institution being a way of processing or handling the fundamental issue of how do these quote-unquote Western powers relate to Russia. So the institution is not an independent variable in the sense that Cohen and Martin would like, but the institution is the vehicle by which these kinds of relations are processed. It is the organization of how these connections actually happen or how these transactions take place.
Yeah, it comes back to this fundamental question, which is, I think, if you're a realist, I mean, I'm sure Charlie would say that we didn't do what we should have done, which is be much more aggressive on PFP for Russia, probably done a lot more to aid Russia, done a Marshall Plan for, I don't know if he would have, if he explicitly advocated for a Marshall Plan for Russia, but essentially do the same kinds of things with Russia that the EU was doing with Central Europe and Eastern right. Europe. But I'm not sure to the degree either that, uh-huh. you know, the United States and NATO weren't holding out. I mean, I think this was the vision of what was eventually going to happen. And I think the PFP, there was the, you know, we mm-hmm. talked about this, there's NATO-Russia Council, there were all these institutions that were supposed to be bridging institutions, there's the CSCE.
Well, even within NATO, there was the NACC, right? Yeah. The North Atlantic Cooperation Council. So the idea of like bringing Russia in.
The question is always,
yeah.
was it not brought in enough, or was it naive to bring it in the first place? And right. I don't think we have a good answer to that. Mm-hmm. It is interesting to see people writing 1995, not NATO expansion is bad or NATO expansion is good, but a lot depends on how we treat Russia during the process.
Right. It is interesting to remember that these were live debates during the mid-1990s. Mearsheimer's position, of course, would be it doesn't matter how we treat process doesn't matter at all. How we treat a challenger, how we treat another great power is irrelevant. What matters is the quote-unquote objective dynamics of balancing under anarchy. So process is irrelevant.
I don't know.
Right?
I sometimes not.
For Mearsheimer, I think process is always irrelevant.
Well, remember that the U.S. is rapacious and aggressive, and that's what offensive realism predicts, but also it shouldn't be. Like, it's imprudent.
Right, but, okay, so process only matters when states don't do what Mearsheimer wants them to do. Then process is important because it's guiding you away from the true path or something. But the idea that, because I take the essence of the Kupchin and Kupchin argument to be the way we handle relations between great powers can be consequential. And we have the potential within the anarchic system to treat one another in a way that isn't just straight up competitive balancing dynamics. We can balance in different ways. And Mearsheimer seems to say, no, we can't balance in different ways because that would be stupid and short-sighted. And if we did, then that would be an example of somehow us moving off of what the actual imperatives of anarchy were.
I think you could make a case that that way of thinking about international politics, which you just articulated, which I think is correct, I think that's how they look at the world, is in some ways more constructivist or constructionist than the way that Wendt describes what constructivism is in his article. It struck me that Wendt's reply to Mearsheimer defines constructivism in a fairly abstruse way, which I think is not wrong, but also not really right. He says on 71, he correctly says that critical IR theory, in quotation marks, is not a single theory, and then he talks about how Ashton and Walker are postmodernists. Adler, Peterson, and Adler, Kratochvil, Ruggie, and now Katzenstein are constructivists, and then there's neo-Marxists, Cox and Gill, feminists, Peterson, Sylvester, and others. What unites them is a concern with how world politics is socially constructed, which involves two basic claims: that the fundamental structures of international politics are social rather than strictly material, a claim that opposes materialism, and that these structures shape actors' identities and interests rather than just their behavior, a claim that opposes rationalism. Which is not really how I would define a big tent approach to social constructivism.
No.
But this is very kind of embedded within the language of the high theory debate between neo-functional systems theorists and more orthodox analyticists, cyberneticists, and that sort of thing. We would just say that a social constructionist view of world politics says that, you know, there's nothing necessary or inevitable about the way that world politics is at any given moment. It could have been different.
Right.
Waltz is wrong that the texture of international politics is sort of immutable. Kupchin is saying, hey, you know, look, you know, if you get enough states doing politics the right way, if you've got enough states making some adjustments, using existing institutions and making some adjustments in the way they do balancing, we could have a pretty nice thing going in Europe, which is actually quite constructivist.
Oh, extremely. Extremely.
But without any of the kind of high theoretical commitments.
Right. The point is, the Kupchin and Kupchin argument is in many ways like applied constructivism in a way that Wendt's response tends not to be, because Wendt's response is much more theoretical constructivism. But the Kupchin and Kupchin response is very much applied constructivism. There is more room to maneuver. There is more ability for process to alter the texture of international politics than Mearsheimer thinks there is. Wendt wants to attack this at the conceptual level. Structure isn't a fixed thing. Structure is just process. Whereas Kupchin and Kupchin want to say, fine, Mearsheimer's right, there's always going to be power politics involved, but that is indeterminate. There could be a bunch of different ways we can practice power politics. So for them, collective security is an alternate way of practicing power politics, as opposed to Mearsheimer's construal, which is collective security is an alternative to power politics. And I actually think Kupchin and Kupchin are correct, that really, if you look at the tradition of theorizing, it gives you collective security. It's not an alternative to power politics. It's a different way of being power political. It's a different way of processing what it means to have these kinds of power differentials between states.
So let's go back to Ruggie. So I have to say, I mean, I think I mentioned already that I was really wowed by this response. Mearsheimer is a very skilled writer. And whatever you can say about, you know, we've come down very heavily against him in these debates. Like, we're judging these debates and we're not scoring him. The RFD is pretty ugly. But he's really just an incredible communicator. But I think Ruggie is easily giving him a run for his money in this piece.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you want to tell us very briefly what your kind of reading of the piece is?
So I think where Ruggie makes his best argument here is in the general claim that if Mearsheimer was right, most of what happened in terms of institution building in the post-war period would make no sense. If Mearsheimer were correct that the constraints of the life of a sovereign state under anarchy necessarily inclines you toward a concern with balancing in this very narrow way that Mearsheimer construes it, then you wouldn't have most of what we see in Truman and Eisenhower in particular. So Eisenhower's efforts to promote European security integration, for instance, make absolutely no sense from a Mearsheimerian perspective. If Mearsheimer was right, then the United States should not have been trying to build up an independent European security group that could threaten what the U.S. was doing. But the record, the historical record, is very clear. This was central to what Eisenhower was interested in. And it's not that Eisenhower was unconcerned with power. He was absolutely concerned with questions of power. It was just that the way Eisenhower and Truman to some extent, but Eisenhower even more in Ruggie's account, the way they were concerned about questions of power is a different way than Mearsheimer thinks that states have to be concerned about power. So the brilliance of Ruggie's is, yes, it's extremely conceptual, but it is teased through this very detailed historical account of what happened in the post-war period.
That's what I find so interesting about this piece amongst the other pieces, and even in amongst, and also Mearsheimer's original piece, which is very kind of big bullet, little bullet, little bullet, big bullet, little bullet. He just tells a story. I mean, this is very much argument through narrative.
Yep. Yep.
But it's very effective.
Oh, it's extremely effective, because what Ruggie is basically doing here is demonstrating through, and I'm going to be slightly cheesy here for a second, because we're recording this on Weber's birthday. Ruggie does something extremely Weberian here. You've got a conceptual architecture, but the value of the conceptual architecture is precisely in what it reveals about the empirics. And he tells an analytical narrative in the precise sense. And that narrative communicates the value of the kind of analytical apparatus that he is working with, which is an apparatus that is deeply concerned, profoundly concerned with questions of practice, with questions of meaning, things that Mearsheimer is not especially interested in. And Ruggie shows us through this story that you really can't understand what the hell Eisenhower and Truman were up to unless you take seriously that they themselves understood institutions to be tremendously significant components of international politics. So on page 69, right, Truman and Eisenhower agreed to involve the United States militarily in the defense of Europe, only within institutional frameworks that promised to transform the organization of European security relations in the direction of a security community. So it's not we have this theory called security community, which we can somehow test against the evidence. It's if you actually look at the practice that these folks were engaged in, the conditions of that practice, the concepts that are implicated in that practice, are extremely different than the sorts of things that Mearsheimer would argue states should have. And the fact that they spent so much time actually trying to implement these protocols, actually trying to do these programs, demonstrates that there's something missing in Mearsheimer's account, that there's more flexibility in the system than Mearsheimer thinks that there is. Because here you have the unquestionable, most powerful state in the system engaging in these other practices.
I would go further by going back to something that you said at the outset. The argument here, as I read it, is fundamentally that Mearsheimer gets power politics wrong. That Mearsheimer's theoretical argument will not allow him to admit the actual practice of power politics by the United States in this crucial period. At its most power political, at its most obsessed with countering the Soviet threat. Because the 50s Cold War is a different animal, right, than the Cold War that happens afterward. It is an axis, it is really a struggle over what system is going to lead the world. And it's not a struggle that the participants are confident of the answer to.
Right.
This is something where the United States believes it could lose. It believes that the world could become convinced that the Soviet way is the right way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Through a combination of suasion and conquest and subversion. And it is not 100% confident that it can demonstrate that, right? So this is an existential struggle between two great powers, and the practice of power politics looks nothing like the way that Mearsheimer describes it. Now, what I think is funny about this is that he opens it by saying he's not concerned with theory, he's concerned with the policy implications.
Yeah, yeah. The extent to which this is a piece that is concerned with policy has to do with the fact that this is very much a piece about process and about the agency that people can exercise in shaping the sorts of actions, the sorts of international policies that they adopt. So it's not policy implications in terms of what the correct policy should be, but policy implications in terms of the realm of possibility for policies, shall we say. If we were to adopt the Mearsheimerian position, then most of the policies that are concretely pursued in the immediate post-World War II period would not be policies that we would think are good ones. We would recommend against them. And Ruggie's point, in a lot of ways, is no, those were precisely the correct policies, and we have to be very careful not to adopt theoretical perspectives that would rule out those incredibly useful and beneficial policies.
Well, at the end, he explicitly connects up Mearsheimer's position about institutions to isolationism. To his discussion of Taft, for example, and says that if we do that, it would be a disaster. So I think, yeah, I think what he says his concern is policy. It's not that he's giving policy advice. His concern, as he says, is he thinks that Mearsheimer's argument is dangerous.
Yeah.
And that it gives succor and to a policy position that will not help the U.S. improve its power political or national security position.
Yeah. No, I think that's entirely correct.
So now we have Wendt. What's interesting about this piece is that it is essentially an opportunity for Wendt to state his argument. There are arguments in here that haven't been articulated in his other leading publications, and they're going to show up in his book, if I remember correctly, or they show up in various places, but they're really arguments that if you read backwards from his book, you can see them here. But this is, and its citation count is not, I think the book is cited 13,000 times, according to Google Scholar. Anarchy is what states make of it. It's close to 10,000. Asian structure problem is close to 3,259. Oh, wow, I have more citations than his third most cited work. total. And then collective identity formation. But this one was on a lot of syllabi.
Yeah, I mean,
I think this exchange was, and this is there was a time, I think, when if you talk to people, this was the piece they knew of as the constructivism piece.
This whole exchange, Mearsheimer versus these particular critics, was for a while understood to be like the encapsulated isms debate of the mid-1990s. And it's too bad because it really isn't the best piece that Wendt has ever written. I mean, it's a response piece. Like, you don't have as much space to be able to sort of stretch out and make your arguments. And the nature of this kind of a quick response is you have to be somewhat more programmatic, which is partially what makes Ruggie's piece so fantastic, that it's not programmatic, that it's just basically a narrative, but it's a narrative with theoretical import. But Wendt's piece, like Cohan and Martin's piece, is, oh, we want to debate this on paradigm grounds? Great. Let me tell you what my paradigm is. Let me give you some basic, pithy formulations of core commitments. So it becomes an awful lot of, like, soundbite exchange.
But it's also, it's very clearly an Alex Wendt piece in the sense that it is also not dogmatically cutthroat.
Mm-hmm.
Where I'm going in for the kill, it's actually mostly like, oh, this is great. That's an invitation to talk more. Let's talk more kind of thing. You know, let's have more dialogue and discussion.
Right. Oh, yeah. No, it's definitely, I mean, it's the anticipation of what in his book he'll call the via media. The idea that, well, we can come up with some kind of a middle ground that we can all debate on. So that tone certainly exists all through the piece here. So, for instance, when he makes a strong claim on page 74, social structure only exists in process. So he's defining what seems to be a really clear line in the sand between him and Mearsheimer, right? I think social structure only exists in process, and Mearsheimer thinks social structure actually just exists out there. But this is still a little bit unclear exactly what that means. If social structure only exists in process, then that means that, what, we can change it at will? No, not necessarily, because then later on in the response, he argues that policies and practices have to respond to various kinds of material realities. So then there's more ground to be able to say, okay, well, sure, Mearsheimer is just reading the structure in this way, but I'm reading the structure in a different way. There is always a commitment in Wendt's work to a future dialogue that everybody could participate in.
Although he is going to argue and does argue that realism is degenerating.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a weird phrasing. It's like he basically says that realists keep on having to invoke things like nationalism or other kinds of forces in order to motor their arguments. And these are the kinds of arguments that constructivists would recognize.
Right.
A set of ideologies, a set of beliefs, a set of meanings about the world are what make the world realist at this point in time. And he says, you know, you should really go back to the materialist roots if you want to kind of defend your position rather than pluck from non-materialist arguments. I want to be clear, this is a very strong response, and it has a very nice discussion, for example, of Gorbachev, very much the way that I was trying to articulate it, only more cleanly. But wow, this material ideal division, I don't know, man.
It's interesting because trying to articulate a constructivist position, there is this particular boogeyman of idealism, which has been invented by realists, as lots of historiography has demonstrated. But this idea that you can think the world good, which seems to be the thing that, especially in this period, a lot of people who are constructivists need to, like, defend themselves. You go, like, no, we're not
And it's the argument Mearsheimer basically, this is how Mearsheimer basically reads what he calls critical theory at the end of the day, as we discussed.
So it's set up both sort of in general, but then in particular in terms of the response to Mearsheimer is I don't want to be sort of saying that.
It's not Wendt who's doing this. It's just the way that this became the terms of the debate.
Yeah.
The way in which, when did realists start saying that they were talking about material power with so much emphasis on material? When did that happen? It's not really in Theory of International Politics.
Yeah, it sort of is. Well, in the appendices, certainly.
Well, he says it's economic and military capabilities.
Right.
But
right.
That's not an ontology of what those are.
No, but the presentation of the data, especially in those appendices to Theory of International Politics, leads to and implies very strongly an emphasis on certain kinds of physical factors. There are no ideas that are floating around in the theoretical universe of the way Waltz characterizes anarchy. And there are certainly no practices, because that's all process and not at the level of structure. I don't think it's actually in Waltz. I think it's in Waltzians. I think it's in the reception of Waltz.
I mean, I know, for example, that Mearsheimer in The Tragedy of Great Power Politics has an argument about why he's talking about material capabilities, and it's essentially, we need to be scientific, so this is what we can measure.
Right.
And it has the virtue of being a very good predictor, right? And Orthodox structural realism would agree that it's a really good predictor. I mean, Waltz's understanding of how we knew what the great powers were is you can just kind of ask people, and they have a pretty good idea, right? It's not mysterious. It's not all that complicated. You know, if you ask people to list who are the great powers, they will generally have the same list, right? Certainly, their rank ordering will be similar at the top. You know, we always got a little funky when you got below four, right, or five, you know, I mean, but to some degree, that's kind of argument about, like, look, it's not actually all that, it's not a big deal. Like, we don't have to go out and measure it. Like, you know, actors have a pretty good sense of who has more capabilities than their actors. I guess I'm just curious, as a matter of intellectual history, I'm not saying Waltz doesn't think power is material. That's clearly the case. He does.
Right.
Right. He's definitely thinking about physical things. He's definitely talking about things that people in our field describe as not. I think a lot of what he's describing is social.
Correct.
But when did the kind of fixation with the idea that what defined realism is material power, not capabilities, not military capabilities, not wealth and treasure in military capabilities, but the materiality of those things. Where does that come from? I mean, we know it's not Morgenthau, right? We know it's not the classical realist. Morgenthau was all this discussion of propaganda.
No, certainly not. It's clearly not classical realist. Yeah, right, right.
I mean, forget Waltz per se, just because Waltz isn't the only neorealist, he's not the only structural realist, he's not the only realist who is in this bundle of new realism or whatever that starts happening in the early 80s or the late 70s or whenever.
Right.
Right. I mean, Waltz balance of threat theory has intentions in it.
And it's clearly not Cox who is the person who coins the term neorealism. Because Cox's understanding of material is very different, you know, being as seeped in kind of neo-Marxist accounts as he is.
I am now very curious about how realism gets associated so firmly with materialism. Like, when these things become synonymous. And I'm not saying that this is saying that's imposed on realists. As I said, Mearsheimer explicitly argues that we have to think about power this way for reasons of measurement and efficacy.
Okay.
I know that realists have said that they focus on, but I'm curious about when this happens. I mean, clearly, I think it's a conflation. It's a confusion. So ontologically, it makes no sense, because most of the things we think about as capabilities are social organizations wielding physical things with physical components, people, tanks, whatever. Mm-hmm. But the tank itself is not power, right? Power is the deployment of the tank, the mobilization of the tank, the creation of the tank, the putting the tank into the field, doing it in an organized way or whatever, right? All these things are power. This is a social product. It's a combination of ideas about the world and modes of production and raw material produced into something that has physical properties. As physical properties matter. They matter for throw weights, how dense your shell is matters, differences between militaries matter in those combat situations, for display purposes and status and just demonstrations of power. There is a physicality, there are physical forces that determine what's possible, or at least put parameters for what's possible. But the idea that it's like, that this is materiality doesn't make much sense.
Right.
And then the idea that realism is equivalent to the importance of material power doesn't make much sense.
Right. What's odd is the most materialist sense of power that I can think of is like Mao. Right? Power comes from the muzzle of a gun.
But even he's talking about social mobilization and...
No, I understandably. But certainly if you look back at Morgenthau, there's a much more subtle and much more variegated understanding of what power is. And it isn't reducible to material components.
Because the claim that that military capabilities is the ultimo ratio of international politics is not the same thing as saying material capabilities. Right.
Correct. I agree with that. Yeah. Something changes between the 1950s and the 1970s. Or maybe 1980s. But there is something striking about the way that Wendt's response can take for granted that realism is about materialism, and that Mearsheimer's argument itself can take for granted that realism is about materialism. Something has become established by this period in the early 90s that configures the debate between realism and constructivism, and you should hear those with air quotes around both of them, as a debate between materialists and people who think that ideas matter. Which is very much what Wendt's response is about.
Because, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm forcing too much into a round hole, but idealism, right, as a description of a position in the interwar period, is not ideaism.
No, it's not. It's not. Idealism as a description is about the idea that, it was about the notion that, not just that ideas have an independent influence in the world in terms of producing outcomes, but that you can achieve a certain kind of ideal.
Right. Yeah. It's the reality of what we might call ideal theory as a practical guide to.
Exactly. But that would be the position that somehow, like...
Or if that we pursue a set of ideals.
Right. Habermas's ideal speech situation could actually be realized in some sort of actual concrete institutional practice or something.
I mean, the kind of hard-nosed people writing about fascism are not taking ideas seriously.
Oh, yeah.
Or, they're not just taking... You know, this is about mass politics, medias of communication.
Right.
Ideas, fascist ideas... The swayability of the masses by rhetoric and propaganda and by aesthetics. I mean, this is not...
Right.
Yeah, I don't know.
No, this is all wrapped up with the idea that ideas have power.
So the response has, like, the greatest hits of Wendt's argument.
Yes.
He does really hone in nicely. He gives a very good, pithy statement of the claim about how pointing out that A lot of realism seems to revert to sociocultural factors in, as I said, motoring arguments along, like giving it the push it needs. This is the Kratochvil and Lapide volume makes this point about nationalism too, right? Or Lapide and Kratochvil volume makes this point about nationalism as well, that, you know, there's an assumption of national identity and a kind of aggressive national identity at the heart of realism, which is now something that Mearsheimer has discovered, right? That nationalism is sort of potent and stuff, and that makes realism true. So, and then you have, for those of you who don't know what we're about, or I'm about, this is what we're about. A nice discussion of the Gorbachev example in the way that is not, you know, that when you start thinking about what's actually going on, and particularly what's going on in terms of Gorbachev's decisions, it doesn't look like the same story that Mearsheimer wants to tell about.
Right.
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 You know, that there are decisions made by agents there
mm-hmm.
that are clearly doing a lot of the work.
Right. So in that way, it's very similar to the story that Ruggie tells, except that Wendt is telling it as a general theory rather than as a specific set of historical examples, the way Ruggie wants to develop it. So Wendt's claim is a little more universalist. Individuals always have, agents always have the capacity to act in these different kinds of ways.
And let's also point out that from Wendt's perspective, part of what he's doing is trying to clean up Mearsheimer's misunderstandings of the what he calls critical theory.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to sort of say, okay, well, this is right. This you know, he says lines like, well, that's about 30% right, or, you know, these are different. Keep in mind, we're talking about different things here. So there's a very different kind of exercise here. Even though it makes some sharp critiques of realism through a lens of sort of, in, you know, isn't it great that we're all having dialogue and et cetera, and even though it does that, there is a kind of like, I have an obligation to explain things to people aspect to
right.
this piece.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And it is frankly to the detriment of the journal that they didn't invite a feminist to respond, because Mearsheimer clearly links feminism to critical theory in this broad sense that he wants to characterize critical theory. And Wendt seems to have been like the designated spokesperson for critical theory. And it would have been nice if they had brought in a feminist and maybe some quote unquote post-structuralists to respond to this, but
it puts a lot of burden on this piece.
It does. It really does.
Because he's gotta both kind of explain that he's not really representative of all of these people, and then he's got to articulate his own position, which isn't that well known and which is fairly technical. So it's a hard haul.
Exactly. Exactly. It really is. It would have been much easier if they had invited a couple of other quote-unquote critical theorists, at least in the way that Mearsheimer characterized critical theory, to be able to carry this burden. But now, Wendt has to bear the entire burden.
Is there anything in here that we haven't talked about that you think you want to pull out for...
So the only thing that I want to call attention to is this claim that Wendt makes on page 80, which he says, a key issue in determining policymakers' responsibilities is how much slack a social structure contains. And this turns out to mark a really important distinction in sort of broadly speaking constructionist social theory. This idea that you can figure out in advance how much slack there is in a particular social system versus the more interpretive or ethnographic kind of position, which says you can't actually determine how much slack there is in a social system until someone has exploited it, so that you can't tell in advance how much slack a particular social system has. And that's a really important ambiguity in terms of the theory. And Wendt is kind of coming down on one side of this. Like, you can determine in advance how much slack there is. And I think that's important, because if you really believe that you can determine how much slack there is in advance, then you can kind of reconcile a constructivist account of the international system with some of these other kinds of accounts of the international system, and just say we're in a disagreement about what the structure of the international system is, which is basically the line that Wendt takes in his 1999 book. But if you really believe that slack in the system is not particularly well defined, that instead we're talking about practices, and what we can do is kind of retrospectively see what practices end up articulating, then you couldn't tell in advance how much slack there is in a particular system, and you would be in a somewhat more radical critique of the sort of analysis that both later Wendt and also Mearsheimer kind of want to do. It would take it out of the realm of being an empirical question about how much slack there is in the system and move it into a methodological question of whether it makes sense to talk about slack in the system as a definable quantity.
Well, it means the embrace of a kind of structuralism.
Yes.
Which a lot of the kind of more, as you say, process and practice and many relational theories, even though they give a strong role, explanatory role to structural, are very uncomfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think that the idea of the amount of slack is alien to something like identity and control, but I do think that the metaphor is problematic, right, in it.
Right.
You know, sort of this notion that the metaphor kind of leads you in almost totalitarian directions, right? Because
right.
Doesn't really let you get at understanding what real contingency is in social system, social processes. You know. So he also has a nice discussion. Let me see if I can find it. Just a nice pithy discussion of how realism doesn't own realpolitik. This is on 76. That
yep.
Realism is an explanation of realpolitik, not a description of it. And this, of course, for Wendt will feed into his argument that realpolitik essentially is a particular kind of sociocultural arrangement, a culture of anarchy, a Habesian culture, to use the metaphor. I actually think, though, that, you know, in this piece, it's not. He's almost using slack as a metaphor. He's got quotation marks around it.
Yeah, he does.
And he's trying to kind of translate what the debate is. You know, and sort of, you know, and it's interesting because it dovetails with kind of the discussion we have Kupchin and Kupchin, not just in terms of the way that they're kind of doing practical constructivism rather than theoretical constructivism, but also that the way you retranslated that is there's a lot of kind of looseness, right? It's not so constraining.
Right. Right. No, I mean.
But I mean, I understand what you're saying, that there's a. That that's kind of where this comes up. You start getting arguments about how anarchy is an empty structure,
mm-hmm.
right? That it doesn't do anything. It's kind of it's a nullity, right? It needs additional stuff to make it something. Now, Mearsheimer's response.
So, I really didn't like Mearsheimer's response. Because in a lot of ways, I think what Mearsheimer does in the response is just basically restate everything that he stated in the initial piece. So he doesn't really take on board any of the criticisms. It's like, let me just double down on what I've already said. And while that makes sense if you are speaking to an audience that already kind of agrees with you, I'm not sure how persuasive that is for anybody else. I mean, he says right on page 82 that the whole issue here is whether institutions have an independent effect and can get states to abandon relative power calculations. So, for him, the issue is always do any of these other kinds of accounts give any reason to believe that states would not be interested in questions of power and their power vis-a-vis other states? Even though most of the critiques accept that states are in fact engaged in these calculations, and all of those critiques are engaged in ways of saying that just being interested in those sorts of calculations doesn't lead you to a certain set of policies, but can lead you to a bunch of other different sets of policies. He kind of ignores that and goes back to the original position that he's taken. So in a lot of ways, his response is just repeating what he said before. In a way, I think the original piece is more effective than the response.
Yeah, it's troubling. So, for example, he says that his answer on NATO, I mean, this line here he has, however, NATO's success in the Cold War cannot be cited as support for institutionalist theory because deterrence has virtually nothing to do with the longstanding claims of institutionalists. I mean, what does that mean? In essence, both Ruggie and Cohen and Martin are shifting the term. Both Ruggie and Cohen and Martin are shifting the terms of debate and making realist claims under the guise of institutionalism. This point's significance will become apparent in the following discussion of their responses. This is like a This is like argument by trademark,
right? Or argument by if they're talking about power, they must necessarily be realists.
Which he basically says at the end of his critique of Ruggie, right? Well, if they're responding to external power constraints, then that must mean realism is true.
Which is, I think, sort of ridiculous.
Well, I would say fine, but what realism? Like, what version of realism are we talking about?
But even
if we're you know, there are a billion different ways. I mean, forget. I mean, you know, Wendt says that realpolitik is a culture of anarchy, kind of Kantian cultures, right? Let's say that you think, you know, we've talked about this in our writing. Let's say you think that power politics is inevitable, not because of the sort of biological nature of the world, but because it's a transcendental requirement of what we mean by power.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, and I frankly am kind of fine with the idea that human beings are vertebrates and we are socially sensitive. And so we care about, you know, it is probably a universal that we are sensitive to patterns of deference and dominance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty rump argument.
Right.
It's an argument, in fact, that we're biologically disposed towards social meaning. But, you know, I know you're looking at me like you're in pain. I'm sorry. But again, you know, it's not constructivist or non-constructivist. It is what's being constructed and to what degree.
Right.
And so here, my answer is, okay, I'm a realist. I think power politics is important. I think it's inevitable.
Sure.
I think there are mechanisms of deterrence mm-hmm. that look like how realists describe them. Well, I'm not sure that realists own game theory concepts. You know, that were developed at RAND.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, okay, fine, right? I think states, I think actors respond to their environment.
Mm-hmm.
I think they have constraints
yep.
imposed by their environment, if that's the language you want to use.
Sure.
I think that, you know, military force matters, that there's a lot, for whatever reason, it could be because of their tokens of power, to use Anna Romanikina's term, or could be because, you know, of their real efficacy, but for whatever reason, like, military capital is really important to the field of great power politics
mm-hmm.
and of power politics.
I buy that.
I agree.
Sure.
Why does that mean I accept Mearsheimer's variant of realism, or even any particular variant of realism that's on the table?
Right. Right.
And I think this is a point where I kind of say, you know what, as much as I enjoyed the paradigm wars and what they opened up, and as much as I am kind of a little bit tired of, oh, the paradigm wars were bad, they kind of did suck sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, no, because ultimately at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter which ism we end up sort of professing allegiance to. what matters is the idea that somehow you have to accept an entire set of claims if you accept that a particular factor matters is deeply problematic and counterproductive. Nobody owns the idea that power is important. But the way the isms debates were construed, you could only really accept that position if you declare allegiance to one side or the other.
But not even power. Material power.
Mm-hmm.
Which is essentially just a synonym for the strength of your military and maybe your economy.
Right.
How much wealth you have.
Right. But mostly how many tanks and guns you had.
Yeah, and the economy mostly matters because it allows you to buy or build tanks and guns.
Exactly, exactly. So...
So, I mean, constructivists don't own nationalism.
No. No. I mean, read Waltz's War, Man, the State, and War. I mean, nationalism is essential to the argument of that book. But there is a weird way that the paradigm, the isms overlay, let's not even call them paradigms because they're not really paradigms in the Kuhnian sense, but the isms...
Somebody should write something about that,
gosh,
Patrick.
Somebody should, and they should call it something like paradigms aren't all they're cracked up to be.
We weren't allowed... We didn't wind up using that subtitle, did we?
I don't know. Did we get away with...
I don't think it wound up being paradigmatic faults in international relations theory. Why... The divisions aren't all they're cracked up to be. I don't think that was.
I mean, that was supposed to be our title, but yeah, I hope that was the title that actually got called. I don't even remember. But the idea that somehow anybody who talks about competition on the basis of power is a realist, like that's a real problematic characterization of what it means to be a realist. Now you're checking to see what the article was actually titled, weren't you?
I am. Nope, there's no subtitle.
We lost
no
our
subtitle.
Subtitle.
Didn't make it in.
Ah!
No, we lost the subtitle.
I liked her.
I can't remember whether we, like, somebody convinced us to take it out or whether they took it out. I don't remember.
I mean, it's not as bad as our losing of the I Ken Has IR theory title. That was still the worst that we lost that.
Oh, so painful.
Mm.
So painful.
But the basic point, just to go back to it here, is sometimes these debates devolve into an argument that if you think a certain kind of thing is important, you must belong to a certain camp. And that's the downside of the isms debate, that it cut these things up into these mutually exclusive groups. There are all manner of ways to say that power and competition and relative status is important. And just saying that doesn't commit you to a particular position. You can make that claim from a quote-unquote realist position, but you can also make that claim from a quote-unquote constructivist position very easily.
And which is the point that Wendt makes, and it's also what Ruggie is arguing.
Yes.
Well, he's not arguing you can make it from a constructivist position. What he's arguing is that power politics is far too varied to reduce it to the idea that institutions are relevant and it's stupid to invest in institutions.
Precisely. Precisely. So it's the inadequacy of the isms to actually pick up the real issues that we're actually discussing.
I mean, I think, though, what bothers me here is less the campism. It's the fallacy of composition.
Mm.
It's the idea that a particular you have a particular configuration of terms in a theoretical relationship, which, say, constitutes a theory. It's the idea that the truth of one of those terms implies the truth of the whole theory.
Right.
And then even worse, you have the additional layer, which is that the truth of theory then proves the truth of some collection of that theory. which, you know, Mearsheimer is ambiguous about. Sometimes it's his version, sometimes right. it's realism at large.
Right.
It's not entirely clear here. It's just not entirely clear. He is very careful, I think, in the original article to say, I am talking about a variant of realism, which is not all realisms. Right. But by now, he's kind of using the term more or less indiscriminately. So I don't know what that means.
Yeah. No, I agree. So. Yeah, the response is less good than the original piece.
The original piece, we obviously believe it has a lot of flaws, but it is well argued.
Mm-hmm.
It has some really nice rhetoric going on it, which is a compliment from us.
Yes.
And it stakes out a position really nicely and cleanly. And yeah, this feels very... John is a really smart guy. This feels a little less than I would expect from him.
It's much more...
But maybe he's, you know, it is, he does have to cover five things and, you know, like the space of six pages or whatever.
No, sure. I even with the constraints of the form, it is more doctrinaire in some ways. Because he's just like, I want to state my basic position and just kind of stick with that. So some of that may be format. But it is definitely less successful, I think.
So, I mean, you could imagine a version of this which was less, hey, look, Ruggie gives the game away because he talks about this being about power.
Right.
And you could just say, of course, it is empirically true that the United States attempted to pursue its power political interest through institutions. My argument is that they did not make... a huge difference, you know, they did not make a significant or substantial difference
right.
in the way the Cold War unfolded.
Mm-hmm.
They were wrong to think it substantially contributed to deterrence.
Yep.
Right. U.S. troops without NATO would have been sufficient. Nuclear weapons without NATO would have been sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
Bilateral alliances would have done the trick. And moreover, a lot of the kinds of things that Ruggie documents that Eisenhower is trying to do that really required states to overcome deep divisions that were more about kind of, you know, they didn't work out that well, right? He had a lot of trouble there.
Right.
You know, even though this was something that you would think on face would be really in the interest of the Europeans, and that is evidence of some of the kinds of things I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, you know, these are not concessions, they're statements of position.
Right.
And you could argue that the process argument, I mean, he does at times, but you don't have to rest so much on these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. No, there's a way that Mearsheimer's response says more about the conditions of theoretical debate in the field in the mid-1990s than it does about the actual substance of the issues. Because what Mearsheimer is trying to do in that response is articulate a concise, finite set of axioms sort of position that can then be deployed against other sets of positions at that point in time. So it's more about establishing a thing called realism than it is about really engaging with the critiques. There is a form, and to be slightly autobiographical, I think this is part of what we were trying to get at in that piece that didn't get its subtitle when it finally got published, that if we were less concerned about establishing the boundaries of the isms and more concerned about the substantive positions, then there's not a need to draw these kinds of artificial distinctions in quite the same doctrinaire way as Mearsheimer is doing, certainly in the reply. That we can say, all right, there's a way of approaching international affairs that takes power competition seriously and says it can't be overcome. versus a version of international affairs or approach to international affairs that says power competition can be ameliorated through certain kinds of rational institutions. Okay, but we don't need to insist on that being some kind of firm ism type quasi-paradigmatic distinction.
Yeah, I mean, a good example of this is his handling of the Kupchin and Kupchin piece. Because he could have just said, he's got a very clear argument, which is, I wasn't talking about what they're talking about.
Right.
Right. I'm mostly interested, you know, as you said, in his Claude, right? This is really, I'm really talking about collective security. Uh-huh. Could have just stopped there and said, you know, what they're discussing does not seem to me to be co-hate enough, right?
Right.
Or clear enough for me to really argue why it's right or wrong.
Right.
To the extent that it relies on balance of power mechanisms, I'm not sure it really makes sense to call it collective security.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, it's you can't marry the two. They're incompatible.
Right.
Right. It's a new version of collective security, which I think we've established is actually not entirely, it's not really true that it's entirely novel.
Right.
That this is one way that collective security in practice is understood.
Agreed.
Not as the automatic, you know, not in this automatic sense, but in the sense of, you know, this is how Article 5, as we mentioned before, this is how Article 5's collective security provision does not require you to go to war.
Precisely. Precisely.
Yeah, it's this focus on mutual exclusivity and things like that.
But again, it reveals an awful lot about the conditions of theoretical debate in the field in the mid-1990s. That this kind of paradigmatism is a dominant assumption.
So the obvious ways that I would say you're correct is you look at like Legros and Mravchak's Is Anybody Still a Realist? You look at some of the ways in which Jean Vasquez articulates his argument, not all of them, but some of them. But I don't see anybody else doing that here. Mearsheimer is the only one here,
right,
who is saying, our theory, you know, my insights cannot get along with your, my insights cannot sit down and have lunch with your insights.
Right.
Right. And figure out a plan of action. Maybe it's just rhetorical style, but it strikes me that Mearsheimer seems to be the one pushing hardest on the exclusivity claims here.
Yeah.
Wendt is going for an incorporation strategy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a supervenience strategy, or was it a super... It's going for a subsumption strategy.
Right.
You know,
right.
What you are describing is a particular set of conditions which my theory can incorporate.
Mm-hmm.
Ruggie says that the position on international institutions is dangerous.
Correct.
Because international institutions are going to be really useful for securing peace.
Mm-hmm.
Which formally is question begging, but then we talked about the content of his arguments.
Right.
Coy and Martin say that, you know, realism in the sense of this broad thing doesn't work for them.
Mm-hmm.
But they certainly allow for room for realist dynamics.
Right.
No, I'm missing something here. I'm getting something wrong here. I think
you're onto something, though, because the assertion of separate paradigms is primarily useful for lines of inquiry that are being attacked and want to basically argue that they should be allowed to continue in their own way. So there is a defensiveness to saying, hey, these are just my assumptions. And in a way, Mearsheimer's strategy reflects that. Whereas a lot of the other responses, a lot of the responses to Mearsheimer that we've been talking about in this conversation are perfectly willing to grant some ground to what Mearsheimer is saying, but then not conclude from that somehow we should accept all of Mearsheimer's claims. So there's a way that one could read Mearsheimer's argument as being, and this is greatly ironic for somebody who is self-identified as an offensive realist, that there's a kind of defensiveness theoretically to the claim. Well, if you are saying that power politics is important, then you must therefore be on my side. So the firm insistence on those differences could actually be linked to a certain kind of insecurity about the argument. Whereas someone like Cohane or Martin or Ruggie or Wendt are perfectly willing to say, yes, these dynamics are important, but they're not everything.
I think we should wrap it up there.
We should probably wrap
it up.
It's
gotten very late. I think we have a lot of material that's going to get cut.
There's a lot that's going to get cut because we've been recording for 2 hours and 53 minutes.
So Patrick and I had a lot to drink, and we were very tired, and we completely forgot to record a sign-off. If you've been missing the podcast, I have some good news for you. We just recorded a discussion of Arnold Wolfer's Discord and Collaboration. So if you're one of those people who likes to read along with the podcast, you've got a chance to do so. Hope to see you on Twitter or Facebook or wherever. Be well.